She was in the caves beneath Creus Adeod, the mouth of God. And it vibrated with energy, with life. It was disconcerting to the young woman. Overwhelming and thrilling and surprising, and somehow entirely familiar. Become aware of your very center, Aulan heard Shona, as if she were seated right next to her stern teacher, listening to one of her many lessons. And this time, unlike so many others, Aulan paid attention. She felt her center, and tried to align its vibration with the song of the crystals within the cavern, like the one that had stabbed her, she realized. Aulan almost lost the moment then, and had to force herself to calm again, to count her breaths, to hold tight to the place of her immediate focus, to bring forth the magic of the song that was all about her. She reached out, not physically, but spiritually, and she felt something, touched something. Something tangible, as much so as if she had grasped it with her hand. And suddenly, Aulan realized that she was not blind, for there was light, all about her, from the walls and the ceiling, shining brilliantly from several diamond-flecked crystals, the bright glow sparkling off the myriad of other crystals jutting from the walls and the ceiling all about her. A beautiful light, Aulan thought, full of color and warmth. The light of Uskar. Bathing her. Shona inadvertently let out a gasp of relief and nearly fell over when the diamonds flickered to life in the cavern. Her concentration faltered, throwing her out of the ritual joining and the farsight spell, and she came back to her corporeal senses, as did the other two women. All three appeared drained, and rightly so. The magical crystals flecked with quartz were typically used for simple glimpses, spying something for a few heartbeats at a time. Yet this trio had been holding their ritual for a long while. Shona was surprised to see that the moon had risen above the mountain now. Shona looked to her companions, noting that Conobra, who was young and doing well within the coven, and so would see no threat from the rise of Aulan, seemed quite pleased by the development within the cavern. Sorka, though, simply looked drained. Shona understood. It was quite possible that Aulan would wind up being Sorka's replacement in a few short years, and while that would simply move Sorka to a similar position as Shona, it was not Aulan's fault. No matter what, someone would be called to the coven to replace Sorka. Aulan was simply the future. Sorka, like Shona, the past. It was always the way, Shona thought, that the older members of the community harbored resentment for the beauty, the strength, the talent of the younger members. It was not just among the coven, either. Shona figured this a universal truth for men and for women. How could an aging warrior, his muscles growing weak, not harbor some envy, some resentment for the young emerging hero? She has heard the song of Uskar, Shona said to the two others. Go and get some rest. And you as well, Conobra replied, her suspicion evident. Typically, the witches would rotate the responsibilities of this night. Now that the girl was awake and active with the crystals, the three of them were expected to pass off their duties to the next watch. In due time, Shona answered, and she smiled, knowing that she had confirmed Conobra's suspicions, and not caring. I will keep watch a bit longer. Conobra just shrugged and nodded, then started to rise. Sorka did not even bother to stand, but simply lay down where she had been sitting, and passed out. No call to exhaust yourself, Conobra warned. Aulan has found her power and created the light. She will not need constant watching. Shona nodded. She knew that she, too, had to rest, somewhat at least. She took up the long quartz-flecked crystal, but did not reach for its magic. Not yet. She hoped to glance in on Aulan every short while. Just for a glimpse. Just an assurance. She reminded herself repeatedly that Aulan didn't need her then. A bit of commotion over by the campfire caught Shona's attention. She noted the tribal leaders, and more pointedly, Te Orlig staring back at her. Then, striding forcefully toward her, he was only visible in silhouette. But his gait spoke of anger. Of course all of that one's mannerisms constantly spoke of anger. A deep-seated bitterness toward the world. Behind Te Orlig, at the campfire, one of the venerable tribesmen rose slowly to his feet. Uskar Forfak Raybert looked fearsome in the firelight, despite his advanced age, and Shona shuddered to remember the man in his youth. He had never been particularly violent toward her, nor toward any of the women, as far as Shona could remember, and he had rarely spoken. But in battle, Raybert had been the most feared man in the tribe, something Shona had witnessed personally only once. A cold sweat beaded on her brow, just thinking of that long-ago day.
"You look fearful, crone," Te Orlig said as he approached.
"Crone?" Shona thought, but did not say. She had thought another decade would pass before she began hearing that moniker. More amused than insulted, she smirked and replied, "Not of you, man." Of course, Te Orlig's scowl showed no sign of relenting. "The girl is awake," Shona said matter-of-factly.
"And yet you're frightened," Te Orlig reasoned. "Aulan must be in some danger, then."
Shona's sudden, wide smile stole his confidence, for it was a sincere and toothy grin.
"I never doubted Aulan," she said. "I'd be telling you more, but you're just a man, and not to know what the girl does in the cave."
"Not to know of the cave at all, eh?" For a heartbeat, she thought Te Orlig might lash out at her, though in truth, she didn't even care.
"Take care your words," he said deliberately, and loomed over her, physically imposing. "Or you might lose your tongue."
Against that obvious threat, Shona's hand reflexively moved toward her pouch and her private stash of crystals, and her mind ran an inventory of them, considering which ones she might use in combination to knock this man away, or even destroy him. Surely Te Orlig had little comprehension of the true power of Uskar, or what destructive forces an angry witch might conjure. But Shona wasn't radiating confidence. She was exhausted from her extended look into the cavern, and her nemesis was right beside her, close enough to strike. And a single strike from Te Orlig would kill. She would have to produce some powerful magic before that to even have a chance, and she honestly saw no way she could accomplish that. But at that moment, Shona did not care. She had suffered Te Orlig's barbs and jabs for years in the encampment, but she would not suffer it here, in this sacred place, the entrance to the cavern that was the source of her coven's power. This was a woman's place, not a man's, not any man's, and certainly not Te Orlig's. She rose to her feet with surprising grace, matching Te Orlig's stare, looking him directly in the eye, her neck craning up at the man. Te Orlig was nearly a foot taller than she, and right now he used all of that height to loom over her, but Shona did not back down an inch. They held that pose for a long moment, neither blinking, neither moving, neither speaking, until a voice interrupted them.
"What are you about, both of you?"
Uskar Forfak Raybert demanded, and only then did Shona realize that their little encounter had drawn outside attention. Te Orlig blinked and stepped back, and Shona slumped back as well.
"The girl is awake," Te Orlig told Raybert.
And for what purpose do you know this?
Raybert asked, his tone brusque. Teolix stammered, so clearly uncertain.
This is woman's work,
Raybert chastised the younger man. Shona started to speak up.
He demanded, she began.
But Raybert didn't acknowledge that she'd even begun to speak. He simply continued on, chastising Teolig.
We have no place in this affair, and we are demeaned for even speaking of it. We are here only to watch over these lesser creatures, and to decide if the girl should be given to Braith now, or if she is destined for the coven. Do not interfere.
He did not even wait for Teolig's response. He simply swung about and walked back toward his campfire. Teolig turned to follow, but stopped and glanced over at Shona. He no longer wore his scowl. Now his face was stone, his eyes unblinking, his smile creasing his face as if he knew something she did not. The scowl, the outward expression of anger, had never scared Shona, had rarely even unsettled her. But this was different. This look, unreadable, had Shona's thoughts spinning and her heart pumping. A chill ran down her spine. Teolig's walk back to the campfire was not the aggressive stride that had brought him storming up to Shona's face. But there was something else in it. Not humility, surely. Shona thought she recognized a not insignificant amount of quiet confidence and satisfaction there. She shuddered again.
19. Harmony and Discord.
It wouldn't stop, each shivering note grabbing at the core of life energy and flicking it, like a million tiny fires burning into every reach of the tormented fossa. The creature wailed and threw itself about the debris-filled pit, sending shards of bone flying all about. The beast leapt straight up, 30 feet, to crack against the ceiling, and tumbled back down into the jumble of sharp-edged skeletons. And it didn't even try to land on its feet, demanding for pain, shrieking for it. Anything to silence the assault of maddening magic. And the beast howled and wailed, full voice, trying to overwhelm the discordant twanging that plucked at its life energies and filled it with such agony. But no matter the demon's volume, the mountain's magic sounded clearly. No matter the crashing and churning, the fires burned bright and hot, so agonizingly hot. The fossa leapt face first into the wall, crashing hard, chipping the stone with its teeth. It sprang as it bounced away, flying across the tight pit to slam hard into the opposite wall, then back again. And again, relentlessly, furiously, insanely. A normal creature would have been killed. Bones shattered in the wild rampage, the long falls into spear-like bones. But such assaults couldn't hurt the fossa. But that song, that noise, that defiant, incessant twanging of the magic of Firaxbuer, that the fossa could not suffer. After another long fall back into the pit, the creature burrowed deep under the pile of bones and kept digging furiously when it came to the stone floor, its rending claws sending stone dust flying all about. It dug wildly, paws rolling, face planted firmly against the stone, which it even bit. The magic had never been like this before. Not this intense. Not this loud. The awful mountain sang now, with full volume, as if mocking the beast, as if it would obliterate the beast. In that moment of agony, the fossa hoped it would do just that, better nothingness than this unending torment. The fossa dug, trying desperately to use the simple exertion, the focus upon its fury and its unending scream, to minimize the taunting notes of Firaxbuer. Trying desperately, and futilely. The winding ways of tunnels began to mesmerize the young woman. Every wall thick with crystals, huge ones, many larger than even the stone of Uskar in the glade beside the winter encampment, all were shining in various hues, some from the inside, the diamond flecks brought alive through Aulan's call to the magic, while others caught that light and twisted it through their angled sides and colored with the various flecks of gemstones and minerals within. It was more than warm in here. It was hot, and Aulan was glad that she was wearing only a simple shift, and even still she felt sweat on her brow. And then there was the music. She could hear such beautiful music, but not with her ears. No, its vibrations were within her, flowing brilliantly, blissfully, elevating her mood and her heart with the song of Uskar. Aulan took in her immediate surroundings. Far behind her, down an unremarkable path, almost bereft of crystalline formations, loomed a solid, unremarkable wall. She had the feeling, perhaps it was a memory, that the witches had brought her into this place from that direction. Had they sealed the entrance behind them as they left? She pondered that for a short while, trying to make sense of it all. What was this place after all, and why was she here? They seemed to be ominous questions to her at first, but only for a moment. For she heard the song, and decided that this was not a place to dread. The ceiling above her arched high overhead, as high as 5 tall men standing on top of each other. To one side, where she had touched the crystals, the cavern ended abruptly, while in the other direction it extended beyond her vision, narrowing and vanishing in twists and turns, to a deeper darkness beyond the range of the magic she had managed to call forth. The floor beneath her was smooth grey stone, but she realized as she looked at the paths before her that they did not remain as such. She would be crawling over and under crystals if she meant to go deeper into the cave. Perhaps she should stay put, she asked herself, and wait for the witches to return. But what if they didn't? What if this challenge was to see if she could find a way out and not simply starve to death on a warm stone floor? Aulan smiled as she grew confident of what certainly had to be the truth. She would not stay in place. Not with these brilliant and glorious crystals all about, singing to her soul. The song quieted, and the light diminished, but only for a moment, until Aulan reached out and touched the diamond-filled crystal again and called upon it, now with purpose and all her heart. The light returned, then grew tenfold, reaching farther out than previous, and with a brilliance to rival a cloudless summer day under the high sun. It wasn't just this crystal she was igniting either, but diamond flecks all about her in a widening circle, as if she was lighting distant torches with her thoughts. Yes, she heard their song and answered their refrain, creating a glorious harmony sweeter than anything she had ever before experienced. She heard other songs, too, some familiar, like Wedstone and Malachite. One cluster of nearby crystals caught her attention, and she moved to them, lightly touching them to feel their vibrating magic. They appeared quartz-like, but more opaque, greenish-gray. They sang of her imagination, of things she wanted to see, of images she might create. She didn't understand at first, but on impulse, glanced back behind her to the wall, almost as if the song of this crystal had bade her to do so. She saw the wall, then through the wall, outside to the glade beyond, where sat Shona and some others, where, farther back and higher on the slope, a campfire burned, and the men of Uskar moved about in the nighttime shadows. Aulan waved, or started to, or she recognized that they could not see her. Something was out of sorts here, for the brilliant light in the cave did not spill out, but was blocked by the wall. But the wall wasn't really a wall. Or was it?
No,
Aulan whispered, one hand still touching the smoky quartz formation. The song was telling her that the wall was an illusion, but it was also an effective one. One that worked both ways, clearly. She realized then that she could simply walk out of the cavern. Was that the test? Aulan smiled. Now, if it were that simple, then she would pass, but only eventually. The song of this enchanted cavern reverberated within her, subtle and sublime, wonderful in its harmony. Aulan felt as if her entire body was vibrating along with it, pulsing with divine energy. As she fell deeper into her focus on that song, she began to recognize the variations in the music, like the subtle bass of the smoky quartz she now touched, or the higher soprano sound of the diamond-flecked crystal she had previously used. She felt as if she were holding Shona's crystal bars, all of them, and dozens more, with an intensity many times greater than those thin, singular notes. She found herself in the midst of a chorus. A thousand voices, lifted beside a thousand drums rattles, a thousand bells, and a thousand flutes. She could play them. She turned her attention back to the diamonds, separated that song from the others. To this point, she had only worked with its intensity, lifting its volume. But now the clever girl coaxed it to sing more softly instead. The light in the cavern grew dimmer. She softened it more and more, extinguished it altogether, and then went further, focusing her thoughts upon darkness, something more absolute than the pitch blackness into which she had awakened. Aulan felt as if she had gone there, as if she had created something more than an absence of light, but rather a tangible darkness. She moved her focus to the side, separating one diamond crystal from the others, and she coaxed that one singular crystal to sing. The darkness remained complete. Aulan let go of all her call to the stones except to that one crystal, keeping it constant, keeping it soft. Instantly she was bathed in the glow of just that shard. The girl put her hand to her mouth, trying to sort the possibilities here. Had she actually done more than halt the magical light? Had she reversed it to create a physical darkness? The thought shook her. Could she walk under the sun and blacken the area about her in profound shadow? The potential for layers and layers of magical subtlety assailed her, overwhelmed her, and then, very soon, captivated her. She brightened the cavern once more, and moved about, looking to the various crystals, listening for hints of their songs, for the many and varied magical enchantment waiting for her call. Aulan pondered the possibilities for a long while. She even glanced back at the distant, illusory wall, and thought to go out and ask Shona, Meryn, and the other witches if her revelation was indeed the secret of the coven. But no, she decided. There lay before her something more pressing, more important, more exciting to do instead. She turned toward the yawning passageway, leading deeper into the tunnels under the mountain. She took a few deliberate strides, her thoughts reaching out as she did for the flecks of diamond farther down the passage, bringing her magical light with her. Aulan smiled. It was time to explore.
It should have stopped by now. But the discordant twangs had only gotten worse, plucking at the fossa's core with every note. It was behind the wall. It had to be, right there. And so the fossa threw itself headlong into the wall, scrabbling, clawing, and biting, digging, determined to get through the stone. Dust and flecks flew all about. But the music,
That damnable music moved, and Fossa scurried along desperately. But no, it was on the other side of the pit, then. The creature sprang away, colliding with its open maw, tearing away, shaving the stone with its sword-like tail. Anything, anything to get at the incessant noise. Eventually, the demon Fossa fell back to its pile of bones, defeated. It thrashed, sending shards flying, and bit some of those into pieces as they spun in the air. No, this could not stand. Up leapt the creature to the slanting rocky crawl space atop the pit, and out it crawled, belly rubbing the stone. The pain increased when it crossed that narrow crawl space, coming into the wider tunnel, out of the shelter of its pit. The magic of Firoxbuer burned brighter and more painfully. The Fossa pushed on anyway. It had to get to the source to destroy the source. A human, of course, playing with the crystals. Around the last bend, the Fossa came in view of the cave exit. And beyond that, the mountain was not dark, for the moon was full, the sky clear. But it was not a red moon, no. The light of the blood moon muted the magic of the mountain and allowed the tormented creature to walk free. But this was a pale silver orb, one whose light magnified the agonizing song of the mountain. The Fossa growled and tried to press on, but was driven back, slowly pedaling backwards step by step at first, fighting the pain and the pressure so that it barely inched along the narrow crawl space. The moonlight won, the song won, and the Fossa spun and leapt back into its death-filled pit, burrowing down to the bottom of a bone pile, then scrabbling at the stone, wanting to get through, wanting to find the source, to kill and devour the source. Anything to end the ringing pain. Somewhere in the midst of that futile, frenzied assault, the Fossa paused to identify the voice of the song, the signature of the source. Someday, it promised itself, playing the thought over and over as a litany against the twanging notes. Someday, it would eat the source, slowly. Painfully, bit by tiny bit. The magical light followed Aulën as she made her way deeper into the cave, the area behind her going dark, while the area in front brightened. It wasn't that the magical light was upon her form, but rather that the call she made to the diamond-flecked crystals continued along with her. And so thick were these particular crystals about the walls and floor and ceiling, that to an unknowing outside observer, it would seem as if she was carrying some sort of magical lantern. The hallway forked, and, in looking down each passageway, she saw that both of those forked as well. The floor was no longer smooth and easy under her feet, and so she had to clamber over giant crystals, or duck, even crawl under others. And in going over the first one, the bare skin of her leg settling against it, she let out a little yelp of surprise from the sting, and understood why it was so hot in this place. The crystals were alive with energy. Too much so, she realized, for her lungs were beginning to burn with each breath. Fearing she would need to turn back, Aulën reached once more into the magic around her, and found a soothing crystal, striated with lines of green and milky white, off to the side wall of the chamber. She made her way to it, a small and curling crystal, and put her hand about it, calling upon its power. She was bathed in a soft, white glow. The heat diminished. She thought of Meron climbing under a bonfire, creating a fireball around herself to rekindle the blaze, then stepping out, unharmed. Aulën let go of the crystal, and stepped away, trying to maintain the protection. She felt herself tiring almost immediately, so she went back, grabbed it again, and simply on a guess, broke the small crystal off the wall. On she went, carrying the crystal, using its magic to minimize the growing heat. She didn't spend a long time in trying to decide which passageways to take, but just plowed ahead, unafraid and enchanted by the magic all around her, by the song of Uskar. "A labyrinth," she whispered at one point, and she thought it curious that she had whispered the words instead of just speaking them, for there was no one around. Yet she didn't want to speak loudly in here, she realized, out of respect, out of a sense of reverence the young woman had never before known in her life. The sheer beauty and power of this place humbled her. But it didn't deter her, and she pressed on, recalling one of Shona's, no, not Shona's, one of the old crone's fables about a child lost in a labyrinth within the mountain. To avoid becoming lost, they, thinking themselves clever, always went left at every fork or intersection. As fine a way as any to navigate such a maze, she thought. And so she took a step down the left passage. But then, Alan remembered the ending of that story. Perhaps it was some sound or smell or something just beneath the level of conscious recognition. But the wandering child got a bad feeling about one particular fork. So proud was he about his plan, though, that he stuck to it. In his blind pride, he stumbled into the lair of the monster that had made the labyrinth its home, and was eaten. The moral of the story, the old crone had told Aulan, was that she should never fear simply becoming lost, because even if she thought she knew where she was going, she could still be vulnerable up on the wild ways of Firoxbuer. Indeed, in the fable, the confidence the boy had gained from solving the labyrinth had tricked him into a false sense of security. The moral Aulan had taken from the story was simpler. Avoid monsters. Aulan shrugged and took another step down the left-hand fork. It was a bit dimmer in here, as this passage had fewer diamonds. Something about the vibration of this passage was unsettling to her, somehow discordant. The young woman stopped in her tracks. She had her answer. She would follow her instincts, like the boy in the story had not done. She would reach out with her affinity to the crystals, listen to their song, and follow whichever path resonated better within her center. She wandered for a long time, through a myriad of turns and forks and intersections with more than two choices. She listened to the crystals at each turn, following the vibrations, confident that she could backtrack in the same manner, so confident, in fact, that she wasn't even noting her choices or marking the walls. Aulan was strangely unafraid. This place felt safe to her, as if she had come home at long last, a place calling to her heart and her mind, inviting her to secrets beyond anything she could imagine. She felt calm, protected by the magic, and she felt a breeze. The young woman paused and spent a long time sorting that out. She licked her finger and held it aloft. Yes, a breeze. A slight one, to be sure, but a current of air down one of the passages. Perhaps an exit. She followed the breeze down a long, winding corridor, and when she rounded a bend, she saw ahead a faint light that was not coming from the diamond crystals. To be sure, Aulan ended her call to the magic, letting the crystals grow completely dark. But the light ahead remained silvery. Moonlight. Figuring she had won the night, Aulan increased her pace, rolling over one crystal, then nearly falling and impaling herself on another as she tripped on a small crystal root low to the floor. As a precaution, she called the magical light just a bit once more, and proceeded. Her curiosity about the caverns was far from sated, but knowing that she had found the way out, and could leave if necessary, would be grand. She decided to locate the exit, then go exploring, both the ways of the labyrinth and, more importantly, the properties of the many pretty-colored flecks she had seen within the multitude of crystals. She wanted to know everything about this place before she fell under the withering gaze of Shona. She wanted to know more about this place than Shona did, more than even the Uskarigin. Alan gasped at her prideful determination. This was a place of Uskar, clearly, and it occurred to her that she should not be competing with the greatest witch of the tribe in such a manner. Still, she wanted to impress Shona, impress them all, and pass their test. I will even tell them of the old crone's fable, she decided, and smiled widely. That smile was so easy to come by in this place of Uskar's song. She pressed on, hardly thinking, hardly looking past her next step, basking in the song. But that song lessened soon after she had turned down this breezy passage, she soon realized. At first, she thought it her own focus dissipating. But no, that wasn't it. The energy here, in this passage, was different than the others. A chill coursed through her bones, and she shivered. She told herself to stop and go back, but she found that she couldn't. Something tugged at her subconscious, pulling her ahead. A few strides later, the light diminished even more. So much so that it took Aulan a few moments to understand that the passage had emptied into a wide, yawning cavern. Her trepidation grew. She sensed few diamond-flecked crystals in here, and they responded to her call with less vigor than the ones in the previous passages, giving off an eerie light, almost like there was a glowing darkness, tinging the edges of the silvery moonlight. Aulan looked up to see the moon, high in the sky above. The ceiling of this deep cavern was the sky itself. The mountain wind moaned as it rushed about those high walls and sounded to Aulan like a giant inhale. Kres Adiat, she whispered. She couldn't be sure. But the cavern spread out wide all about her, but she moved to the center, drawn there inexorably. It wasn't just the moon or the breath of the cavern, but the shadowy darkness that drew her. And she quickly realized that the floor fell away before her. A huge, deep pit with no visible bottom filled most of the place. The eerie darkness emanated from it, fighting the edges of the moonlight. Not a physical darkness, Aulan thought, but something different, something more profound. Something that made this place so different from the rest of the labyrinth, made it cold instead of warm, frightening instead of inviting. If the rest of the place emanated life itself to Aulan, this place seemed quite the opposite. Consciously, Aulan told herself to be away from that pit. She even found herself whispering, "Go back," repeatedly as she slid her foot forward. Had she found the monster of this labyrinth? Her freedom shone above her, high above, tantalizingly and unattainably. She wanted to be out of this place, but there was no place to climb. There were no walls near enough to the moor above for her to hope to get there, for the opening was right above this pit. The cavern's walls were far away in every direction, all ending at the high ceiling. None near that lone crack that was letting in the moonlight. At last, she managed to pull away from the pit, if only just a few steps. The spell broken, Aulan considered her options. She didn't want to wander the hallways any longer, not even to get back to where she had started, and certainly not to explore any more. There was a chill in her bones, and she had seen enough. "This is my test," she whispered. And the epiphany shined as brilliantly as the moment she had turned on the diamond-flecked crystals. She thought of the night of the ritual with the tattooed man who would be her husband, and of how she and Shona had climbed the ledge to the fire. The green-flecked crystals. The malachite. Aulan closed her eyes and tried to sort out the songs of Uskar. She ended her call to the diamond and listened for the subtle vibrations of other notes. She moved to the wall and felt the crystals, but it was difficult for her to sense their magic through the mind-numbing chill that had crept into her bones.
"Focus," she whispered, squeezing her eyes tighter.
She imagined herself climbing the wall, using the crystals growing near the ceiling to pull herself along to the opening. At last, she felt the same magic as she had felt in Shona's tent, the same magic they had used to get up the cliff. Sensing more than seeing, she reached for a slender crystal rod protruding from the wall. Gripping it tightly, she shoved down with all her strength, breaking it off. She yelped as she cut her hand in the process. A deep wound. Alan felt her blood pouring out, feeling lightheaded and close to fainting. As she caught hold of another crystal to steady herself, she recognized its magic as that of a whetstone. Hardly thinking, Aulin reached out to it and brought forth its power, its warmth driving back the chill of the cave and washing into her hand, sealing her wound. Her relief lasted only until she heard the whispering hiss behind her. A profound coldness pierced through her, shocking her with pain. She stumbled backward, away from the wall. Her eyes popped open wide, but she could still see very little. The whispers grew around her, sinister and cold. She saw a light, tiny and far. The moon, she thought, and she stumbled toward it. She tried to call out to the diamond-flecked crystals again, but she couldn't find her focus at that moment. A cold hand grabbed her, and she screamed. But no, not a hand, she realized. Something icy brushed against her back. Alan spun about to see a deeper blackness before her, a human shape, but unnaturally stretched and swirling, constantly in flux, blowing apart and coalescing at random. Alan could just make out a face. Her face? As though she was looking into some dark mirror. Or her face in death? In desperation, she punched out at it. But her fist and the crystal she held passed through the non-thing. She felt coldness, that terrifying shiver grasping at her chest. And the shadow specter leered at her, and wanted to steal her warmth, to devour her with its cold. Or it was her own being, her shadow self, calling her to her grave. Aulin cried out again, and fell back. Her lungs burned with cold, and she could not see. And the floor was gone, and she was falling into the pit, into the darkness. And she was dying, and there was no hope. 20. Virgin Vista. Corte slipped her hand into Talmadge's, as he stood out by the lake shore, staring up to the southeast, where the full silvery moon hung over Fíorach's Buaer, as if put there just to limn the mountain in brilliant silver light. Talmadge glanced over at the woman and started to look back to the heavenly orb. But she didn't, instead catching the reflection of the moon in Corte's dark eyes, and suddenly she became to him more than a bystander, but an integral part of the beauty of this windy night beside the loch, with the village of Cár Saileach behind them. This was their third visit to Loch Bheag together, though Talmadge hadn't yet dared to take her beyond the village of Cár Saileach. The tribe had welcomed Corte more openly than Talmadge had thought possible. Talmadge assumed it was because her Togai Rú upbringing had given her a greater affinity to their ways, a greater appreciation of the rhythms of the land than any travellers from Hans the Bear the tribal folk may have encountered. In a way, Corte spoke their language even better than he. Talmadge shook his head, admiring her beauty, almost lost in the sheer attraction he felt for her. "What is it?" she asked, turning to return his stare. "I feel foolish," he said. Corte arched her eyebrow, her expression doubting. "The moon is beautiful," he said, looking back to the southeastern sky in a clear move to change the subject.
Yes.
Talmadge could feel her gaze still upon him.
It is so bright, you can even see the fish swimming in the lake, he exclaimed, pointing. Look!
But he knew that she wasn't about to be distracted, and he finally sighed.
Hi,
she prompted.
I didn't want to bring you.
Ever. Now that seems a foolish choice indeed.
I told you that 2 years ago.
I know.
And you're just now sorting that out.
It is more than that.
Much more. I have kept your bed warm, and you mine, she said, and squeezed his hand.
It is more than that as well, he answered without hesitation.
Truly,
she replied, a sudden flash of indignation filling her voice and face, and causing Talmadge's eyes to widen as he realized that his statement could be construed as quite an insult to the woman's lovemaking techniques.
No, I mean...
he stuttered and stammered. Coté laughed at him warmly.
Truly,
Talmadge went on, trying to realign the conversation once more, suddenly realizing that it was important to him to express these feelings.
I did save your life with those fools back on the river, she said. It took that to get you to let me come along.
Not even that, Talmadge answered somberly. Though I'll never forget your heroics, fear not.
It's more. I have carried around the ghost of Badger for so many years, and now it is like the sun or this beautiful moon has chased the shadow away. And it is more than even that.
He paused and sighed, amazed at all of the emotions suddenly flowing through him, demanding release. Emotions and feelings he had never before recognized, but that now seemed as clear as the moon hanging over the mountain.
I hide out here, he admitted.
I hide from the other frontiersmen with their bullying and raucous foolishness. I hide from the fighting and the disease.
He looked her squarely in the eye and spoke to her nod. I hide from my memories, from the pain. You walk the same road over and over because your own footprints comfort you,
Coté said.
You accept...
I accepted having nothing, being nothing, having no one, and being no one, Talmadge said quietly.
To avoid the pain.
She moved closer and kissed him on the cheek.
Your life is a bard's tale, and better that story if your life is a tree with spreading branches. Write your own story, my dear Talmadge. Wander the ways of the world and of those feelings that burn and twist within you. Put your fears aside. Should not the greatest fear of all be the fear that you will die without ever having lived?
So easy to say, he replied. Coté laughed at him and kissed him again, then whispered into his ear,
You took me to this place, did you not? And twice took me back.
When he didn't immediately respond, she pushed him out to arm's length and painted a pained expression on her face.
Do you regret that choice?
Now it was Talmadge's turn to laugh, and with more than a little embarrassment.
Of course not, he said to Coté's knowing smirk.
But before he had even finished the response, the woman was tugging him along towards the small hut the tribe had offered them. They left the flap open, for the door faced the lake, and there were no huts between this one and the waters, and doing so let the silvery moonlight sparkle and splash in upon them in their lovemaking.
Talmadge thought this night a chapter of his story that he would never forget, and ever relish.
Under that same moon, high up on the mountain, Shona stared at the crystal of Farsight with a look of complete frustration. She had privately looked in on Aulan to glimpse the girl leaving the entryway and moving along the maze of Crystal Cavern, lighting the diamond crystals with ease. But Shona wanted more than a simple glimpse. She wanted to send her magical vision back in there now to follow the girl's progress. Could Aulan call up some of the other crystals as easily as she had ignited the magical light?
Would she find Kresadiad?
And would she at last recognize it for what it was?
In the larger scheme of things, that didn't really matter, she supposed. Alan had revealed her easy affinity with the magic of Uskar, and just the display Shona and the other two had witnessed would surely be enough to secure her a place on the coven when came the next opening. No other woman of the tribe, not already among the witches, was remotely close to this girl's inherent understanding of the crystals. And Shona even wondered how many in the coven possessed such insights. Maud Garad had been held by the women of Uskar for generations, forever in the counting to the tribe's memories and oral histories. It was not without danger, for some women simply could not handle the unrelenting blackness and the radiant magical energy of the cave. Some few panicked wholly, and would lie shivering on the floor throughout the night, feeling the effects of the cavern in an acute, unfocused way. They were usually broken and mad by morning. Some never to recover. But truly, Maud Garad was one of the two great dangers to young Uskar women, the other being childbirth. All who went into the cavern felt that panic to some degree, Shona knew. She had, and so had Alara and Mirren, and just as had Aulin. The measure of the young women was more regarding how they recovered from that panic, and whether they could then go on to enact the magic that would show them the beauty of Uskar about them. For the majority of women who could regain their calmness, the night would be spent in meditation, feeling the vibrations of the cavern in the spot where they had been placed. Even these women would emerge the next day, exhilarated and eager to continue the magical training. But alas, it would be minimal. Rare were the girls like Aulin, ones who proved so naturally attuned to the crystals that they could produce light or other effects. Most of these women would still simply stay in the antechamber of the caverns and explore the magic of the various crystals. When Shona saw Aulin producing light and standing, she thought the girl might take this path, and she was happy. But Aulin's affinity with the crystals was matched by the uncontrollable young woman's insatiable curiosity, and she had taken the rarest and most dangerous path of all, setting out to explore the ways of the labyrinthine cavern. It was said that women choosing this path had been, without exception, the greatest singers of Uskar song, if they survived. But that was the problem. For most of those who went into the caverns on their own during the trial, so untrained and unprepared, never returned. Shona winced, reminding herself that her own fate would be tied to Aulin's. If the girl did not return, Te Orlig would likely get his way and return her to her husband. She looked down at the crystal of Farsight once again, frustrated to the point where she wanted to throw it away. There was nothing to do now. Magic could not be sent deeper into the caverns from the outside, not through Farsight, or Far Walking, or any other means the coven had ever discovered. The vibrations of the multitude of crystals within simply prevented such outside intrusions. Aulin was alone. Shona, too exhausted to even walk back to the coven's fire, collapsed upon the ground into a fitful sleep of terrible dreams. The moon was still up, though low across Lochbjug, when Talmadge crawled to the threshold of his hut and peered out at it once more. He loved it here. Perhaps what he had said earlier rang of truth, that he was hiding from his pain, but that didn't change the fact that he truly loved this place. The light was different here, both under the sun and the moon, and he found it comforting and pleasing. He glanced back at Khote, sleeping on the mat, and considered her words, her way of life. To her, it was a storybook, and one to be made thick. Or, as she told it, her life would be no pole, but a tree, spreading wide with hundreds of branches, hundreds of side roads to catch her fancy, and full of blossoms. She had known many men, and had probably killed many too. She had travelled the world, to the Myrianic Ocean, and now, as far out here in the wild as any Togai Ru or Bearman of Hons had probably ever gone. Except for Redshanks, Talmadge whispered with a chuckle.
What about him?
Came Corte's voice from right behind him, and she was against him before he could even turn to regard her, looking out at the full silvery moon.
Nothing,
Talmadge answered. I was just thinking that he has probably enjoyed this very sight from this very place. The book of his life is thick. Talmadge smiled.
Six other villages?
Corte asked, and not for the first time in the 2 years since she had first known this place.
Seven, if you include the one on the mountain.
You don't include that one.
No.
So, six?
She asked again.
You will be visiting six more before you turn back to the north and east?
The man shrugged. Are all the views as grand as from here? Corte asked, although Talmadge realized that she was asking much more than that. This time, though, the question sounded a bit different to him.
The same, he replied, though he broke his response a bit short.
Mostly the same, he corrected.
So, if e'er I was to make that journey, I'd see little different than I'm seeing this night, looking out across the lake.
The mountain would loom behind you from Fossach Cran, Talmadge admitted. A giant shadow upon you the whole of the morning. There is a different feel to that.
But that's the place you like the most, said Corte.
And the man nodded.
Mostly the same things to see, though,
she asked. Talmadge paused and considered his next words carefully. He didn't want to lie to Corte. Not ever. And there was one place out here where there was indeed much, much more to see. Seladh Tulloch. All the way across the lake, directly opposite Car Silich, if one rode directly to the east from this spot. Seladh Tulloch overlooked the desert of black stones, and most of the world, it seemed. Talmadge realized, and admitted, that he wanted to share that view with Corte. He pointed straight out across the lake and said,
The world looks different from the other side of the lake, from Seladh Tulloch.
Mountain view?
Corte asked, properly translating the name.
There are many ways in which the language of Togai resembles the word spoken here, she explained. It would not surprise me to find that the tribes here came from the steppes,
or maybe the other way around.
Corte thought it over for just a moment, then nodded.
I want to see the world from that place, then, she decided. The way she spoke, and the way she backed off from Talmadge and stiffened just a bit, told him that she expected a roaring argument over that. 3 times he had taken her to this place, Car Silich, the safest of the lake villages, the one most open to outsiders. And the only easy approach to this region came down this side of the lake. But in their previous journeys, he had never wavered on his refusal to bring her to the other, less inviting and far more dangerous villages. Indeed, Talmadge's first instinct was to shake his head, and his denial of her request was almost out of his mouth. Almost. But he looked at her, sitting back, chewing her lip, so hopeful, and he knew that he couldn't deny her.
There are 2 other villages, only a day's walk, he explained. We will go to them together this time, and return to this place in no more than a week. If you hold in the good graces of those lakemen, and the ones here, I'll take you across the lake and let you see the world from the high vista of Seladh Tulloch.
And if not? She asked slyly.
I'll bury your corpse, Talmadge replied immediately. If the lakemen have not already eaten you.
Corte's face went through a series of quite funny expressions then, as she tried to wind her way through his surprising statement. In the end, though, Talmadge's grin gave it away, and the woman went back to him to share his view of the full moon. And
to kiss him.
21. Curiosity and courage.